Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans, Head of the Department of Languages and Linguistics at La Trobe University. This is episode CLXXIX, Q&A VII. That's right, for the seventh time, we have asked you, the lovely listeners, for questions, and here we are to give you our answers. Hello, Rhiannon.
Hey, Matt.
It is the end of the year, and I thought, hey, end of the year is a good time for a Q&A episode. So we asked for lots of questions, and we got lots of questions, didn't we?
Yeah, you shouldn't have asked for lots. It was more than ever.
Yeah, I know.
Do you think people are bored or something?
Oh, well, yeah, possibly. Yeah, so seven Q&A episodes in, and we got, you know, more than 80 questions, which is really great. So shall we crack on and try to answer as many of them as I've got in front of me?
We'll do our best.
The first one that we've got is from Russell Piet. What type of jobs and titles were there in Rome, in particular ones that we don't have now?
So let's concentrate on the ones that we don't quite have now, because there were lots of types of jobs in ancient Rome.
Yes.
Obviously. All the way from, I guess at the top, politician, which we still have.
Yeah.
Let's face it.
We still have senators. Yes.
Yeah, we do in this country, exactly. And you go all the way down to a lot of jobs being done by slaves. A couple that come to mind that are very specific to Rome, I think, although you might see parallels somewhere else. There's the great job title of praegustator, which literally means before taster.
Yes.
So someone who tastes your food before you taste it.
It sounds like a very digestive kind of word, that one. I don't know.
Yeah, well, yeah, the gust is, yeah. I guess we talk about gusto, which is an Italian word that I think means enjoyment of food originally, but means generally enjoyment. And the pri always is like the prefix pre, so doing it beforehand. And of course, it's specific to Rome, although must have existed in other cultures too, that there's this fear of poisoning. So have someone unimportant taste it beforehand for you.
When we say unimportant, is that a slave?
It will be a slave, yes.
Okay.
It's a slave, possibly a freedman, a freed person.
Yeah.
But usually you would just delegate this to a slave to make sure that there was nothing bad in there that might get you. Of course, we see this happening with, say, in the whole saga that is the Julio-Claudian dynasty, that often in Suetonius or Tacitus, they'll tell us that there was a suspicion of poisoning, so precautions were being taken.
Mm.
Right? This is one of the precautions.
Definitely, if you're going to have dinner with Nero, you would want one of these guys around.
Yeah, Nero or Domitian both have terrifying banquets. Yeah. So. Yeah, you'd need to hire one or buy one.
Mm.
Yeah, so praegustator, I think, is the most outstanding one. Another one that sprang into my mind was ornatrix, which is someone who makes you ornate, literally. And the ix ending means it's a feminine ending. So you could technically have an ornator, male, but they seem to have been primarily female. And it's somebody who adorns you. So the orn bit is like adorn.
Yeah.
So it might be someone who does your hair up. Well, we do have hairstylists, but also other things to adorn you. So they would also be potentially makeup artists, someone who arranges your clothing. And you might think, well, these roles do exist in different spheres. Certainly if you act on stage, you might have someone to dress you.
Mm.
But it's kind of a combined dresser, hair person, because as you might know, in some periods, Roman women have very ornate hairstyles,
yes,
hair pieces, the Flavian hair in particular, which, you know, grows out from the head in a big, presumably wig, but be very time consuming to attach that. Well, if you can afford it, then get someone in to do it for you.
Okay. Okay. Well, that sounds like a job that could exist now, but maybe something like a lictor.
Ah, okay. Yeah, lictor's a good one.
Job that doesn't exist anymore, really.
Yeah, I guess we have attendants for important people, but this is a particular kind of attendant. You're quite right. A lictor is the group of people who carry rods and axes in front of and often around somebody who has imperium.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a marker that they have power. They literally have the power to hit you with the rod or chop your head off with the axe. That's kind of what it symbolizes.
Yes.
That they have the right of life and death over Roman citizens, I guess.
Mm.
But it is a sign of power, and also that these people should protect that person in their importance. Consuls have them, emperors will have them in the imperial period, and you will see them on reliefs. So if you look at a relief often on a triumphal arch or some other piece of relief sculpture, there's sort of a whole group of them surrounding the important person who's part of the triumphal parade or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's, of course, obvious ones like, you know, a gladiator. We don't have gladiators anymore.
Which well, there's this TV show, hasn't it, in memory?
Now you're just dating yourself, because even that is ancient history.
It is, I know. We have things that are sometimes compared to gladiatorial sport, like we don't in Australia, but bullfighting.
Oh, which is still done in Colosseums in Spain, isn't it?
Some parts of Spain, yeah. I think it's been banned in Barcelona and surrounds. But it still exists in some parts of Spain and Portugal and maybe other countries too. I think in France at one point.
Mm.
So that's only against animals, I guess. People fighting each other, again, you'd have to draw a bit of a long bow, but boxing, wrestling, it's not like getting at each other with a sword or a huge trident, is it?
Mm. All right, so we should move on from that question before we just do a whole podcast on that topic. The next one that we've got is from Dennis from India. Could you please talk about the place and importance of love in the lives of Roman men and women during the Augustan age? How similar were Roman notions of love compared to ours? Are these ideas reflected in the poetry of the period? Many thanks.
Okay. As far as I know, that's our first question from India, so that's great.
Perhaps, yeah.
It's a big question.
I know, yes.
It's a huge concept, this kind of emotional area that is love. And Dennis has asked very specifically from the Augustan period, and that is when we have a lot more textual evidence for, in particular. So we have, and we should be careful with this evidence, as I'll mention, we do have a whole body of love poetry from that period that we call Augustan Love Elegy, written by people like Propertius and Tibullus and a female writer, Sulpicia. The kind of love they lay out, it's very much part of that genre, and there are specific roles. So when the men write Propertius and Tibullus, they very much put the woman in charge. She's called the domina, which literally means mistress. She kind of lords it over the man, and she's often married, so it's an adulterous affair. We don't know how much this reflects any kind of reality amongst Roman elites. I guess they're writing from that perspective. In the past, it's been taken as, oh, there was this kind of, what scholars at the time called this demimonde, this half world where this kind of shady stuff went on. And this is why Augustus had to bring in those laws to kind of cement marriage and encourage marriage and outlaw adultery. But as I say, it's poetry. It's a literary genre. I guess it does reflect the centrality in a way of marriage in Roman culture. Because this is happening outside of marriage, so it positions itself as something slightly rebellious. And we know people had affairs. But to get back to love, there was always this ideal of marital love, or certainly marital affection, as what you should be striving for. So while we might think of marriage, particularly amongst the elites, as very functional, very much a contract set up between often the father of the woman and maybe the family of the man too, that's not to say that the Romans didn't idealize love within a marriage. And when it seems to be there, when affection seems to be there on top of this contractual marriage, it's often pointed out by our biographers.
Mm.
So, for example, they talk about it between, this is before the Augustan period, but between Pompey and Julia, that Pompey was genuinely distraught when Julia died.
Yeah.
And similarly, this is slightly after, actually, no, this is during the Augustan period, sorry, Tiberius and Vipsania, who he's forced to divorce, and he doesn't want to because he loves her.
Yeah.
It's quite hard to get a very specific answer to Dennis's question. It's such a big question, but some of the same kinds of ideals existed, I will say that there's a kind of frisson to having an affair, and there's also an ideal of ongoing affection within marriage.
All right. Thanks for that question, Dennis. The next question that we'll take is from Robert, who lives in Tacoma, Washington. Was Latin the only language used in an official capacity, or did Rome allow the provinces to conduct official business in their local languages? What special insight can be gleaned from extant material written in non-Latin languages?
Okay, this is a really good question. Most of the official... So by official sources, I mean maybe the lists of the consuls or documents showing us what supplies are being ordered in for a particular army or a particular group, contracts between people. They will be in Latin, especially if we're talking about the western half of the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
So Latin kind of is the official language, the language of officialdom and empire. The Romans seem to have shown remarkably little interest in learning other languages, with the very notable exception of ancient Greek. every educated Roman will know ancient Greek as well.
Yeah.
Partly because they should be all tooled up in Greek literature. You've got to be able to read Homer. You've got to be able to read the tragedians or Demosthenes, the orator. But also because the eastern half of the empire is much more likely that official business is conducted in Greek. That's because those Greek kingdoms existed there before the Romans conquered. So we've got, for example, that Macedonian kingdom in Egypt. You know, Cleopatra the VII and her family,
yeah,
the Ptolemies, are Greek. In that part of the world and in some other parts of the world, you do find bilingual or trilingual inscriptions. So that's official business usually. And sometimes bilingual is Latin and Greek. Sometimes, say in Egypt, it might be ancient Greek and there'll be hieroglyphics as well.
Mm.
It's kind of a shame there's not more of this because this helps you to decipher some languages that you might not know otherwise. If you know ancient Greek, then you can tell certain things about what's going on in the language you don't know.
Yeah, that's the Rosetta Stone.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's the key. Mm. And so we do have some inscriptions like that. And we do have the odd one that does that for one of the languages that we know, or some people know, alongside Punic, the language of the Carthaginians, or alongside Palmyran, the language of Palmyra in Syria. But as far as I know, not enough to really decipher those languages. I think Punic is still being worked on.
Yeah, yeah.
So not that much is the answer.
There are inscriptions that are over in, as you say, Palmyra, in which, say, they'll have a votive prayer up or a well-being wish for a caravan that is going past, and it will be in Palmyran Greek and Latin, just to cover all of its bases. And then you get other structures like the now fallen triumphal arch that was in Palmyra, with the official dedication being in Palmyran. So they didn't even try Latin in that instance. They just went with the local language.
It shows you what they're trying to appeal to.
Mm.
That if there are local people who don't know Greek or Latin, then what is the point of putting it up there?
Yeah.
Because it's essentially a propaganda device. I think in the vast majority of cases, there's an assumption that people might still be speaking whatever Celtic language they're speaking in Gaul, but they might not read it. I mean, Caesar tells us that the Gauls don't write things down.
Mm-hmm.
So you may as well put your inscriptions up in Latin.
Yeah.
I mean, it worked in Gaul, didn't it? Because France has a language that is derived from Latin. So it kind of took over. So it's different in different parts whether Latin wipes out the local language, but it seems that the Romans maintained this as their, literally their lingua franca.
All right. Thank you for that question, Robert. We'll take a quick question here from Judy from Port Arlington, that place. Will there be a Raising Standards Season 2 watch and review? Will we be watching Season 2 of Rome?
What do you think?
Well, we've recorded the first episode.
Gave it away!
So we've got 9 more to go. So yeah, we will. That will probably be going up sometime in January
once I've had
a Christmas break. No, I'll get to it. We've done one interview with Lorcan Cranich. Erastus Fullman.
Nasty guy.
Yeah, so that'll be going up shortly afterwards, I think. So yes, we will be going on with Raising Standards. There's a potential that we'll be taking a break from it early next year. We'll see how we go. We did that this year as well and kind of banked up the episodes so that they were ready to release once we had a good run of it.
I have to say, I thought that's what we were doing with all of this.
As I say, occasional rewatch podcast.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We'll see how we
take that. We're excited to do the rest of it, but it's all time dependent.
Yes. The next question that we've got is from Claude Lemelin. This one might get your rankles up a little bit. His question is to the inventiveness of the Romans. What did they invent or discover in what for us is pure and applied sciences? Other than concrete, I have read that Romans used the knowledge from the Greeks and did not add much to the corpus. All right, I have wound Rhiannon up and off you go. What did the Romans ever do for us?
I think this speaks to a kind of broad understanding is sometimes claimed that the Romans just took everything the Greeks had and then spread it through an empire, which is not true. Certainly in terms of what we have of ancient pure sciences, so I don't know, something like geometry, that Euclid wrote a treatise on. We have that from Greece. We have it from a Greek author, and the Romans knew of it too. So it might seem like the Greeks had worked this stuff out and then the Romans ran with it. I guess one thing I'd say is we don't know what had been worked out previously. We kind of have texts from the Greeks, whereas we don't have that much from the Babylonians.
Okay.
I mean, that's kind of a side issue. It's not about the Romans, but just I studied the Greeks when I was an undergrad and postgrad, and I adore ancient Greece, but I don't like the idea that the Romans were just kind of coming along and stealing everything. So it's an interesting question, though, because certainly the Romans did use, they're not going to reinvent the wheel. They're not stupid. Mm. If the Greeks have worked something out, if they've worked out a scientific concept, they absolutely will take that on board. I'd say something that is often ascribed to the Romans that is a really important piece of technology and builds on what Claude is mentioning here with concrete is the arch. So the architectural form of the arch, so like the ones in the Colosseum, which helped them, of course, build these incredible aqueducts, which they're very famous for, and buildings like the Colosseum, which I'm sure I've bored you with before, but would probably all still be standing if it hadn't been pillaged. It's very, very strong. It's strong because of the concrete, which is better than ours, and it's strong because of the arch form, which is a really strong form that it's hard to break down.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't just fall down of its own accord. So arches are one of my favorite. I guess there's triumphal arches too, but the triumphalism aspect of that is a bit less acceptable.
But even to the extent, I guess, then of the dome as well. You've got on the Pantheon a quite impressive dome, and that wasn't a concept that was just for that structure. There was domes all over the place.
Nero had had a fantastic one in his golden house that you can still visit. It's kind of underground now. The dome is a really good example, and the Pantheon dome was the largest freestanding dome in the world until St. Peter's in Rome, so many, many centuries. I sound like I'm an apologist for the Romans. I guess I am.
given the podcast,
But I mentioned aqueducts before. Of course, there's a lot of development of the kind of sanitation that that can bring. Mm. So drainage systems and sewers. They were very proud of their sewer, the Cloaca Maxima, that goes all the way back to their kings, they think. Mm. So pre the Republic, pre 6th century. Yeah, so in terms of those structural forms, I think they alone contribute an awful lot.
All right, thanks for that question, Claude. Next question from John Faulkner in Melbourne. What is your opinion of the portrayal of Roman history in McCulloch's Master of Rome novels?
I've only read one of them, The First Man in Rome, which is the first one, which deals with the period in the early 1st century BCE. It's basically Sulla and Marius, the early years before they come into conflict. And I quite enjoyed it. It's a bit of a page turner. She could write. And I think this question is perhaps asked because in some ways she's often thought of as a very populist writer, so not serious. But we do know that she really did her research. And in fact, she gives her sources at the back, which, you know, is more than sometimes our students do. These ideas about Marius came from the life of Plutarch. I've invented this character. Marius was married to the Julia, who's related to Julius Caesar. And she invents a younger sister who's married to Sulla to kind of tie them together. But she tells you that directly. So I think it's actually pretty good. She's very happy to make you aware of what she's invented and why. So it's kind of interesting to see that process and her laying it out. With all of these things, I'd say it's really easy for students to read that and think that is the history. So it's really important to distinguish the two. And she's kind of encouraging you to do that. So, yeah, I think it's pretty good from on the basis of that one novel. Okay. I haven't gone on and read the rest. They're very long. I will say that.
Fair enough. All right. The next question that we'll take is an audio one. This is from Denis Laberge.
Hello. My name is Denis Laberge, and I'm calling from Quebec, Canada. My question is, what happened to the original literary sources that describe Roman events and literature? How did this information depicted in these sources survive? And how do we ascertain the accuracy of this information? Thanks very much.
That's a really good question, Denis. Thank you for that. So I think there are a couple of things involved here. So part of it is what happens with the sources that survive. I'm not sure if you're wanting to cover that, but briefly I'll say it's like a lot of other sources. So something like Livy that gives us an insight into the very beginnings of Rome. It survives through being copied out and copied out and copied out.
Yeah, it's a copy, it's a copy, it's a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy.
9th, 10th century is early.
Yeah.
Sometimes you've got nothing earlier than the 15th century or even later. It's a big gap. It's not ideally what you'd want. And this is why academics spend so long looking at what could be a scribal error, because there's plenty of chances for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to them? Well, they degraded and they were lost. Or sometimes libraries were burnt down. You know, the Library of Alexandria was destroyed. We've lost a lot of that stuff because it was not in the conditions in which it could survive. So if you think about things that have survived from antiquity, it's like the Vindolanda letters. And that's in very special circumstances where they've been buried underground. They had the right conditions to survive.
And they're written on tablets. You know, it's more survivable than something that's on a papyrus scroll or on a scroll of some sort. And it's kind of unrealistic to think that those sort of paper products are going to survive a couple of thousand years.
Indeed, alas. Mm. That maybe leads into the next question. How do we ascertain the accuracy of this information? Well, even for Livy, it was difficult because, as Livy stated, he couldn't actually verify the accuracy. He didn't have anything written down from before about 400 BCE because Rome had been destroyed in around 390 and everything, all the records destroyed. He is sort of going by oral tradition. He's going by what's been handed down. Later on with, you know, if he's dealing with the war against Hannibal, he'll tell us, I've got these sources. So he has sources to draw on. So that seems more verifiable. But you've got so much to take into account, like his Augustan perspective, like what had been lost even during his period. And for us, we have to take into account what has been lost now. So we might be relying upon Dio Cassius for huge swathes of Roman history.
Mm-hmm.
Well, look, he's writing in the 3rd century in Greek, from the kind of Greek half of the world, which doesn't mean he doesn't have access to great records as much as exist then. But as we know, even by that period, things had been lost.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a sifting process.
There are points, though, where you can like verify something that an ancient historian has written, which is a nice kind of touch. One that comes to mind is that, you know, we've got accounts of Hadrian being in Egypt and his boy love
Antinous
dying in the Nile. And if you go to Egypt and you stand next to the Colossus of Memnon and you look really carefully, you can see the poem that has been written on the legs of that for Hadrian. And that's talked about in the text. So you can corroborate some things in some instances, which, you know, might make you feel better about reading Dio and believing what it's written there. So, yeah.
I like Dio. I find him a good read. But yeah, you're right. It's rare cases where we have some material evidence that supports a speech or a visit or whatever it is. You know, for the vast majority of Roman history, we might only have one account.
Mm. All right. Thank you for that question, Denis.
Kind of leads into the next one, but maybe that's too close.
Yeah, no,
I mentioned libraries there.
On the same note then, this one's from David from Montreal in Canada, another Canadian. What are or are there any famous Roman libraries comparable to Alexandra? And do we know of any large or important private libraries or great collections?
Yeah, we do know of a few. We know, for example, that Julius Caesar put someone called Varro in charge of setting up the first public library. That might have come to a sticky end because Varro was proscribed after Caesar's death. He was on the wrong side of all the civil wars. His own library, which was also a great private library, was confiscated by Mark Antony. Varro himself had written 490 works, it is claimed.
Yes.
So they may have been destroyed at that process. We certainly don't have very much of Varro left. It would be nice if we had Varro's library, either his public or his private one. I'll take either. but there are others. So we have an account from Plutarch's Life of Antony. Antony's coming up a lot here. I'll read it out from chapter 58. Calvisius, who was a companion of Caesar, brought forward against Antony the following charges regarding his behavior towards Cleopatra. He had bestowed upon her the libraries from Pergamum. So this is kind of imperialism, meaning you can steal a library and give it off as a present to your wife, in which there were 200,000 volumes. So this is not a Roman library. It's kind of a library the Romans take over from the east, from Pergamum. But 200,000 volumes sounds pretty substantial to me. At a banquet where there were many guests, he had stood up and rubbed her feet in compliance with some agreement and compact which they had made. I feel like that bit doesn't need to be there.
I feel like that's a bit superfluous. Sorry. Matt, stop copying text there.
Yeah, okay. We'll wipe that bit out.
But Plutarch does concede that this is probably Octavian's propaganda that this happened.
Yeah, a lot of anti-Antony stuff, of course, comes from there. Mm. We do know also that in the imperial period, putting up a great library, it's like putting up a public building generally.
Yeah.
It's a sign of beneficence to the Roman people and the grandeur of Rome. So there were libraries put up by the Augustan regime in the Porticus Octavii, so the Porticus of Octavia, Augustus' sister. Trajan is definitely following suit when he puts a library, the Bibliotheca Ulpia, in his forum, right in the center of his forum, close to the column.
Yeah.
So either side of the column, there's a Latin library and a Greek library. And that actually reflects what very rich private citizens would do. They would have a library in each language.
Mm.
Hadrian, of course, anything the Romans were doing at home, he did it in Greece. The Library of Hadrian goes up there. So it's kind of a marker of the Romans or the emperor gives a great benefaction to the people.
And one of the famous private libraries that we've still got in existence is the Villa of the Papyri, which is in Herculaneum.
Yeah, which we think is the library of Piso, Caesar's father-in-law. So
he was a big fan of Epicurean texts.
Indeed, yes. And there may be more to be discovered.
Mm.
So those are texts that survive from antiquity, contrary to what I was saying to the previous question.
Heavily carbonized.
Yeah.
Need a good x-ray to be read, but they are still there. Thank you for that question, David from Montreal. The next question, this one's from Cheryl Watson. Which Roman should have been an emperor but never was, but would have been better than who went on to become emperor? She is thinking of Germanicus and Britannicus. I think most Romans would have been thinking of Germanicus, actually, both of who were done away with. There must be others.
Yeah, it's always easy to be a great emperor if you never were emperor.
Mm.
Tacitus actually has doubts about Germanicus, so maybe he wouldn't have been as wonderful. These figures often get put forward in contrast to the emperor you've got. All right, so Germanicus would have been better than Tiberius. Well, you know, he wasn't even in Rome most of the time. I think, and I completely admit that this is watching I, Claudius at an impressionable age, but Drusus, Germanicus's dad, who is portrayed as somebody, actually portrayed as a republican, but if he'd been emperor, he would have been emperor in a very kind of democratic way, is the idea of I, Claudius. That is kind of intercepted by a modern source there. I'm going to say Drusus. And secondly, I'm going to say Agricola, because we've been talking about Agricola ourselves quite a lot. And he's portrayed by Tacitus as the perfect man. So even though he stomped all over my ancestors in Britain, it's more the ideals that he's meant to represent. The fact that he is humble, fair to his soldiers. He kind of thinks about how to encourage the locals to be Romanized, but in a hopefully not heavy-handed way, apart from when he's slaughtering them. He's kind of depicted as the ideal emperor. And I'm going to go really left field and say I'd like to have seen somebody like Fulvia in charge. So, you know, get a woman in.
Yeah,
She actually conducted battles during the period of conflict of the first century BCE, Mark Antony's wife. I'd have liked to see what she had to do.
Okay. All right. That was left field because I was expecting, you know...
only men.
I was expecting Augustus's wife, Livia, to make an appearance.
Yeah, Livia would be interesting too.
Yeah.
For sure.
Thank you for that question. The next one that we've got, this one, is from Pablo Martin from Buenos Aires, Argentina. We're getting around the globe today. Mm-hmm. The word Brutus in Latin has a meaning not unlike the modern word brute, that is dull or stupid. Why is it that an adjective that seems so negative becomes a common cognomen for the Junii?
Yeah, okay, so this is the family of Marcus Junius Brutus.
Yeah.
So it's the family of the Brutus, who's one of the assassins of Caesar,
mm.
who we've been talking about a lot in our Raising Standards episodes. That name is supposed to have come from the, I guess, seen as the founder of the family, who was similarly a tyrannicide, an ouster of a king. The first Brutus, who Livy tells us about, getting back to Livy, who before he ousts the kings is supposed to have acted in actually a very clever way. So he kind of acts up to this stupidness of his name, this dullness. One of the ways he does that is he pretends he doesn't understand an oracle that the Romans have gone to consult. And the oracle tells them that the first, you must remember this story, the first one of them to kiss his mother will take power in Rome. So when they get back to Rome, he pretends he's fallen over, trips over and kisses the earth because he's interpreted the oracle properly, that the mother is their earth.
I haven't heard that one.
He becomes one of the first consuls of Rome.
There we go.
So I guess it was seen as an ironic name for that reason, because he wasn't stupid, but he kind of hid behind a kind of pretense of being this fool who trips up and doesn't really understand the oracle, whereas underneath it all, he does. And also, you know, Roman names, they're not always the glamorous ones you might think they are for elite families. Like, you know, Cicero's name means chickpea, so which is one of my favorites. Ovid, Publius Ovidius Naso, is the name the Romans would have called him. Naso means nose, which must mean someone in his family had a big nose, presumably, or a nose that stood out.
It's good. Usually it's just focusing on, you know, a feature of a great-great-great-grandfather, and that name has stuck.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, this one that we've got now is from Sylvie Carter, who's from regional New South Wales. I'm curious to learn more about which of the emperors was the most supportive of the arts and or which artists and why.
Okay.
So, patronage.
Yeah, I mean, it's patronage, which is a Roman tradition before the emperors. It's something that Augustus is famous for, certainly promoted about himself. And he's kind of a patron of the patrons, if you like. So during the Augustan period, there are people like his very close friend Maecenas, who is a big patron of the arts. He's a patron of Virgil and Horace. And Augustus is a kind of secondary patron, in effect. And, you know, we have that account of Virgil going to read part of the Aeneid to Augustus and his sister Octavia. And it's the part where he tells about Marcellus, who is Octavia's dead son, and she breaks down. So we know that, if that's true, that Augustus was interested enough in the arts to have poets come to him and you know, show him their work in progress, as it were.
Yeah.
And it is mostly poetry that we know about, although we know that the emperors must also have fostered the material arts, because their palaces, say Nero's Golden House, have fantastic wall painting in them, and, you know, the architecture they could employ and did employ the most famous architects of their time. And you're probably going to tell the story about Hadrian not getting rid of one of them, so it's not necessarily a safe job.
What's Apollodorus of Damascus?
Yeah.
That is allegedly getting rid of.
Yeah, so maybe being too close to the emperor, not entirely safe. And indeed that is true of Nero, who's also seen as a patron of the arts. But, you know, he ordered the execution/suicide of Lucan, who was the prime poet of the day. What we have from him is an epic poem, The Civil War, but it's unfinished because he was forced to kill himself after being implicated in a conspiracy against Nero. But I would say the three big ones of the first century CE are Augustus, Nero, and Domitian.
Okay.
So there's a kind of flourishing of poetry in particular in each of those periods. And we know that Nero was really interested in the arts, and he performed on stage. You know, he's interested in composing himself. In fact, one of the stories about why he had Lucan killed is that he was jealous about how good Lucan's poetry was.
Did you get works that were specifically dedicated to their patrons, say, in the opening few lines or chapter or something?
You do. So Horace dedicates their shorter poems, his odes. There are a few dedicated to Maecenas or that mention Maecenas. But increasingly you get poems dedicated to the emperor or that mention exploits of the emperor, even if it's an epic poem set in mythological times. They'll might find some way of dragging in, say, the Flavian emperors. Big poet Silius Italicus does that.
Is Ovid's Fasti dedicated to Germanicus?
Yes, it
from
is.
Memory?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So it's a good idea to name check a member of the imperial family, I guess. That you might get patronage that way, or, you know, you might get the word spread, even if it's not money you're after. We think Ovid was independently wealthy. Didn't work for Ovid, who fared very badly under Augustus. But you need to not write naughty poems, seems to be the answer.
Okay, so the next question that we'll take, and I have audio for this one. Let me find it. This is from Seth in Darwin.
Hi, this is Seth from Darwin, Australia. I'm 18 years old and I love the podcast. I've got two questions today. First one is on Domitian. When Rhiannon was in school, were you taught that he was a useless or incapable administrator? And how do you feel about him now? Obviously, that goes for Matt as well. Second one, coins. Do you collect or have a collection of Roman coins? P.S. When's the next Anthology of Interest out?
Okay. Well, Anthology of Interest, when we get to it, next year. I am slowly working on one in which I ask every academic that I interview the same question, and I'm then going to edit all of those together. So it's going to be an Anthology of Interest with a lot of people in it. So far, I've done three. So that might be later on next year. But as for Domitian, I guess the best way, because I didn't learn about Domitian in school, I didn't learn about Domitian until I started doing podcasts with you, Rhiannon, would be to ask, how has classical reception of him changed? Have we reevaluated him within the past, you know, few decades?
We definitely have. I didn't learn much about Domitian until I was at university, and partly we didn't learn much about Domitian, let me preface this and say, because there was this very old-fashioned sounding division between Golden Age Latin literature, and I was primarily studying Latin literature then, which is Virgil and Horace and Ovid, and then that later stuff. And because the Domitianic period, which had, you know, some amazing literature, was that silver stuff, not as good. We didn't do very much of it. We did do Tacitus because he's, you know, he's important. He is important. Tacitus's view of Domitian, which is extremely negative, was pretty much left unquestioned. And I think this is a function of Domitian being one of the assassinated emperors and the sources being taken mostly at face value. It's only in the 90s, and it takes a while to filter through, I think, to uni education, that people started to work in English anyway on that reevaluation of Domitian. So you've got books by Brian Jones, writes a book on Domitian in, I think, the early 90s, and then Pat Southern, Domitian Tragic Tyrant, in about 97. So it's probably this century that people seriously started thinking about Domitian in a different way, thinking about him psychologically, not being prepared to be emperor, that Titus is always the golden boy and he's just kind of the secondary character, wondering about the kind of frame of mind he was in, if it's true that he was killing flies as a child, and also thinking about the kind of dangers that were around him. So maybe there was reason for him to be paranoid. So, yeah, my view has changed on Domitian. Part of that is what I've already mentioned, that he's emperor in a period where he certainly encourages the arts, which is something interesting, you know, I would say positive. Interesting period in terms of the material arts as well, the kind of architecture and art that, you know, that really extreme Baroque stuff that appears during that period. So I guess maybe not so much negative and positives, but I've seen Domitian as more and more interesting as I've gone on, and the Domitianic period, as there's a lot more to study there.
Okay, very good. Do you think that the reevaluation of Roman emperors who are traditionally seen as negative can go a bit too far?
Yeah.
Yeah?
I do.
Have you come around on Nero after the exhibition at the British Museum there?
Not specifically from the exhibition. I've always thought Nero was a bit more interesting than that. I mean, he's somebody that we really have to have a lot of sympathy for being emperor at 17. I don't want to see these people as negative or positive, though. If you want to get really philosophical, I don't think we'd have much in common with any ancient Roman. So I don't think we'd be buddies with them. But I do think that it's a mistake to demonize them.
What I enjoy about doing this podcast is how much I can come around on an emperor that I will go into thinking about as being a negative person, and I will reevaluate them during the course of doing these episodes. So there's always more that I don't know just because I come in with misconceptions.
Yeah, because we get the broad brushstrokes about a particular emperor being brutal or, you know, a warmongerer. We increasingly know that that is often a senatorial point of view, so we need to take a lot more evidence, as much as we can, into account.
All right. Do you collect coins?
I don't collect coins. Some of my students do. Mm. Occasionally they bring them to me to show me, which is really interesting. I do have a few figurines that have also mostly been gifts of Roman soldiers quite often.
I'd love to collect coins. We don't get coins here, though, in Australia, do we? You're not going to find a Roman coin.
eBay?
No. Well,
you mean collectors in find?
Yeah. No. I think I've got a Septimius Severus coin somewhere. Yes. Please send coins. All right. The next question that we've got is from James Ollinger. Sounds like Ollinger. Oh.
So say Olinger.
So maybe read the phonetic instructions there before you read out the names. Hi, James. I recently read that Romans bred and used working dogs. What kind of dogs did they use and for what purposes? What was their relationship and opinion of dogs? Did they ever keep them as pets?
Wow. This is a question I'm interested in because I love dogs. Yeah, they did. They did have working dogs. They had them for things that might seem familiar to us. They had them for hunting and for help with farming.
Yeah.
I think a bit less herding in the farming use than a lot of the evidence seems to be about protecting the herd. Maybe modern farm dogs are used in that way. I'm not sure. The person we're going to keep coming back to in this episode is Varro. I've already mentioned him once.
Yeah.
So he's around the first century BCE. He wrote, as I've said, an enormous amount, 490 works. We've got one complete one.
Yeah.
And it's on agriculture. The Res Rustica is in three books. And in book two, he says there are two sorts, for hunting and for herding, so for farming. But he talks specifically about how they protect the sheep and goats. And then he says, but not the pigs, because they've got tusks and they can do it themselves.
Mm.
And they're protecting them from attack of, say, wolves. And he talks at one point about them having, you should put on your dog a kind of spiked collar. So if a wolf attacks, they can't get their throat.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
so he's thinking very carefully about this specific role that they've got, and it's quite a dangerous role. And he goes into detail about how to choose the right kind and how to train them. You know, the Romans must have been breeding them exactly for these purposes. It's a bit of a nasty read for me, but he talks about some kind of harsh disciplinary stuff. You should whip them, basically, if they don't do what you want them to do.
Mm.
Also, the other side of that, hunting dogs, there was, this is going to sound a bit bizarre, a poetic genre of hunting dog catalogues. And by catalogue, I mean lists. So we know of one. In fact, we have one that's not often read, by a man called Gratius in the first century BCE, so around the same time as Varro, which is one of these hunting dog catalogues. If anyone's read the Metamorphoses of Ovid in book three, there's a kind of catalogue of Actaeon's dogs. He's the hunter who gets turned into a stag. That's playing on that. So these lists of this kind of dog who had this quality and this other one who was fast of feet. And it's so much in their psyche that they have a form of poetry that's about hunting dogs.
Okay.
And just listing them.
Mm.
Doesn't sound fascinating to us, but it worked for the Romans.
What about outside of those sort of activities? So, I mean, I've seen many times a dried Roman flagstone picture come up on Twitter or something like that. And you can Google these as well, where a dog's walked across them while they were driving, or a roof tile or something like that. And you'll have doggy footprints going across them. So dogs were around. And what about in the domestic setting? Did you have things like handbag dogs being taken by a lovely lady to the games or something like that?
We don't know of that. No, there's no kind of Paris Hilton stuff going on as far as I know. We know that they were domestic pets. And we know they were kept as guard dogs of houses. And there's that famous mosaic in Pompeii, which says, Cave Canem, beware of the dog under it. So that's the reason you're keeping that dog, to keep your house safe. And yeah, so they're pets, they're working dogs. It's similar to a lot of our uses of dogs in many ways.
Yeah, we don't often hear about them in the text, so I guess they were just, you know, there. If they were there, why would you talk about it?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the most famous one from ancient literature is Odysseus's dog, and that's Greek, very much Greek literature and culture. There's a lot of affection there, that's for sure.
I bet you, though, if Caligula made one a senator, we'd know about it, you know?
I cannot think of a good example. There must be one. Somebody will write and tell me.
Yeah.
But, you know, you'd think I should know. The only example I can think of is of a picture of a dog scaring someone because they're afraid it's a real dog.
Mm.
And that's in Petronius, Petronius, mate of Nero's, who also gets executed by him. But anyway, his work, The Satyricon, and that's meant to show us that the character's an idiot.
Okay.
That he doesn't recognize what's a real dog and what's a painting.
All right. Thank you very much for that question, James. The last question that we'll finish off, and this is looking forward to the next year of emperors in Rome. What Roman emperor / philosopher / theologian / person are you most excited to cover next? That is Matthias from Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, covering his bases there. What are you looking forward to covering next year, Rhiannon?
Oh, well, I have to say, I didn't realize you meant what were we really covering or just which people I was excited about at the moment. So the person on my mind at the moment is Varro. So I reckon he should be on our long list.
All right. Okay. Let me write
down.
But
I don't know if he'll get covered next year. That is not a promise.
We are recording that in January. Let's go with Varro.
But I believe, correct me if I'm wrong here, we're going to be looking at Catiline soon.
That'd be a good intention.
Yeah.
Okay, you heard it here. We've done that. This is how we come up with all our plans for it.
Yeah, we're kind of doing production live here.
And with Kaelin Davenport, I will be covering at some point Valerian and Gallienus, so they're the next two emperors from the 3rd century. And really interesting period that we're coming up to. So Valerian was the only Roman emperor to be taken captive alive, and he spent about 10 years in captivity.
So it was all falling apart by then, clearly.
Yeah, and Gallienus, that's a really interesting time when the Roman Empire fractured into three parts. So you've got the Palmyran Empire going on there, and France had its own thing going on as well. So, yeah, interesting times ahead before he stitched it all back together for a little while at least.
We should mention somebody else I've already talked about today. Not all blokes. I would like to look at Fulvia at some point.
Okay.
She's a fascinating woman. Unfortunately, not loads and loads of evidence, but I think still enough.
Okay, I think I know where we can put that. All right, we'll leave it there for the Q&A. Thanks, everybody, for your questions. There were a lot of them, but hopefully we got to some of them. And I hope you have a good Christmas, and we'll see you all next year on Emperors of Rome.
Yeah, all the best for me, and thank you so much for your questions.
That was Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans, Head of the Department of Languages and Linguistics at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review. They are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith, Io Saturnalia, and thanks for listening.